if we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
Welcome indeed. It is 8 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock, and we are underway on this Monday morning. It is the 29th morning of the fourth month in the year of our Lord, 2024, and we've got a really, really packed show for you today. A little bit out of order because we have been asked to adjust our time schedule for Congressman Jim Jordan, which we are happy to do. Congressman Jordan normally joins us at 9:35 on Mondays, but he's going to join me in about 2 minutes, actually, as we get our program started. He's got a very, very busy calendar today. We'll give you top 9 at 9 at 9:35, so we'll call it that, top 9 at 9:35. So that is still going to happen today. What else do we have going on today? We have some other guests on the program coming up in, what are we looking at, about an hour, yeah? We're going to talk to Dr. Larry Brooks. Dr. Brooks and I are going to be discussing DEI. We're going to talk about an op-ed that he wrote for the National Review about neuropsychology losing its mind. No pun intended, as DEI has invaded that field, as well as things like, you know, airline pilots and physicians and so on and so forth. Neuropsychology, interestingly enough, of course, is the study of the brain. And it is indeed the brain that leads to all of this, all of these disorders, these psychological disorders and social contagions. And now we won't even be able to have qualified neuropsychologists able to deal with these things because they're all going to be hired based on their appearance rather than their qualifications. So we're going to talk to Dr. Brooks about that. And at 10:35, there is a potentially troublesome, and maybe even more than potentially troublesome, bill called HB 472 in the state of Ohio that has to do with elections and how the state of Ohio conducts its elections. The Republican, it's being called a Republican bill that would tighten Ohio voting rules, and there are some issues with it. We're going to talk with Marcel Sturbridge. That'll be coming up at 10:35. We'll tell you all about that then. But before we do anything else, let's get our Pledge of Allegiance. Patriots, go ahead and stand and face the flag if you have one, if you are a believer. If you are a supporter of Marxism and the Joe Biden regime, well, then don't stand and proudly and pledge that flag. You may instead take a knee so we can identify you as the Marxist dog that you are. For the rest of us,
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I think that one played in stereo, actually, strangely enough. But there you go. The day is underway. We can't start the day without our pledge. Now let's welcome Congressman Jordan. A little bit early on the program this morning, but we're happy to accommodate anytime we get an opportunity to catch up on what's going on Capitol Hill. Congressman, good morning. Yeah. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, Bob. Great to start off with the pledge there. Did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, it was actually a very nice weekend. We had some decent weather for a change. We got some good things done. Got a little yard work done, so it was good. How was yours?
All good. Yeah, very nice.
You got yelled at by Maria Bartiromo, though, so that's probably not
good. Yeah.
It was kind of similar to last week when I played for you Steve Bannon, who's, you know, and I'm going to just let people hear a part of what she said so that you can respond to it here directly, because, you know, it's not something I haven't said to you. You know, I express a lot of the frustration that my listeners have when they say, next time you get Jordan on, talk to him about this, 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 and when is something going to happen? And I know that these questions get very frustrating for you, but real quick, here's what Maria asked you.
American citizens are asking, what can you do about it? I mean, look, with all due respect, people are sick and tired of congressional investigations that go nowhere. People are sick and tired of letters being written and sent to the people who we know are bad in the first place. They want you to do something about it. You're an elected official. What can you do to right these wrongs?
And I'll let you answer directly here rather than replay what you already said to her. Because, like I said, I feel the frustration, and I know you do too, right?
Look, I think every American does. I get this question all the time. But we're a legislative branch. We have separate and equal branches of government. We can't prosecute anyone. We can't indict anyone. We can simply do investigations. We can do reports. We can do referrals. We can subpoena for information. And we have done all of that. 90-some different subpoenas I've issued this Congress, 120 depositions and or transcribed interviews. We've done... I don't know how many reports, probably hundreds of reports, interim reports, full reports. So we just issued a report last week on the situation with Alvin Bragg. So we passed legislation to if you have a president or vice president be indicted by a state court, a state prosecutor, some DA like Alvin Bragg and Fonnie Willis, that case should be moved to federal court. We passed that legislation out of our committee. We think that makes just good common sense. Now, it hasn't been brought up on the floor yet and hasn't went to the Senate, but so you can do legislatively, take legislative action, and you can do your constitutional duty of oversight. And we're doing all that as vigorously and aggressively and as consistent with the Constitution as we possibly can.
Yeah, it's important to note what you just said at the very beginning of that, and that is you are not you're a legislative branch. You're not a judicial branch. You can't bring charges. You can't, you know, try somebody. There are only certain things that you can do, and that is provide the information to the Department of Justice, right? The results of an investigation conducted by Congress can be turned over to the Attorney General, the DOJ, and say, here's what we found, and then they have to decide what to do with them. And we know that the Garland DOJ will do nothing, right?
Right. Now the other big power we have, and this is one that we have not used as vigorously as I would have liked, is the power of the purse. And you and I have talked about this numerous times. And the founders, in their wisdom, actually thought that the House in particular would be, if there was one branch of government a little more equal than the others, it was supposed to be the legislative branch, and particularly the House, because you had the power of the purse, the power of controlling the money. And all taxing and spending authority has to first start. Those bills have to start in the House of Representatives, that body closest to the people, that body that's up for election every 2 years. Now, unfortunately, I think we've let that power sort of slide away and given too much to the executive branch, and we need to reassert that. One of the things that I was so frustrated by in that spending bill a month ago was the fact that in that bill there was a $200 million additional appropriation for a new FBI headquarters, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. That never should have happened. So that's the power we need to exercise, I think, with a little more authority than we've been doing in the past.
Yeah, well, you know, and it doesn't help the fact that you have such a very, very narrow majority. And even when you have, you know, it has shrunken since 2022, you know, which was, you know, we were supposed to have a red wave and we got just a little trickle and we had a very slight majority. And it's even gotten smaller since then. And, even if you have a one or two or four member majority, if you have a bunch of recalcitrant Republicans who don't want to go along with, you know, with the goal of limited government, fiscal responsibility, spending restraints, and all of these other things, you can't get anything done at all, especially given the fact that the Democrats have the slim majority on the other side of the chamber, the other chamber.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think when people look back at this Congress, they're going to say the three things that stand out are when we funded the FBI headquarters, which we shouldn't have done, when we didn't get the warrant requirement on searching the database that is put together under the FISA 702 program, and frankly, when we gave $61 billion to Ukraine. I think those would be the three votes where the people say, why didn't you push harder on those things and get done what you told us you were going to do? And I think that's just unfortunate.
Yeah, well, it's more than unfortunate. It's quite frankly, it's infuriating. And I know, again, you're infuriated as well. But people continue to look at you because you're vocal. you're vocal and you're visible. You're out there. You know, a lot of congressmen stay behind the scenes. They just go to their committee meetings. They do their work, and they may, I don't know if they have any town halls or things in their districts. That's between them and their constituents. But when it comes to the Congress as a whole, as a committee chairman of somebody, you know, particularly as powerful as judiciary, and to sit on oversight, you're very visible. You do a lot of your interviews. You do mine. You do tons of other radio and television. And so you kind of paint a bullseye on your chest. You are the person that we have to go to. Believe me, I'd like to yell at Dave Joyce for a little while. He won't come on. I'd like to yell at, you know, Max Miller more than I get a chance to. He comes on a little bit, but you put yourself out there, and I think it's a little bit unfair that we kind of target you. And I say this as somebody who addresses you very, you know, critically a lot of times. It's a little bit unfair that we make the people who make themselves available to us the scapegoats for all of Congress's failures.
No, that's fine. You're doing your job, and that's why your show's so good. I understand that, and it's frankly, I always tell people, you pay my salary. You know, I don't get the privilege of representing you like we used to, but you still pay my salary, and you're allowed to let me have it. That's how this great experiment in liberty called America works. Mm-hmm. So I'm fine with that, but I am going to get out there and talk about what I think needs to be done, and I'm going to talk about the things I think we need to be investigating, the legislation we need to be passing. I think that's part of my job. And I do try to, and we've talked about this a bazillion times on your show, I do try to do exactly what I told the voters I was going to do. I try to go there and fight for the things I told them I was going to fight for. And if people come after me, they come after me.
Congressman Jim Jordan is our guest. He is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He sits on the Oversight Committee, also chairs the Weaponization of Government Subcommittee. Let's talk about presidential immunity. What do you expect to hear from the Supreme Court after what you saw or what limited information we did get from some of the questions that were asked by the justices last week?
I thought Sauer, the lawyer arguing for the president, did a great job. I think the experts are saying it's likely that it'll get sent back to the lower court. They'll sort through the facts. They'll establish some kind of test. And, you know, there's basically two elements here. Were you president and were you acting in your official capacity? I think the answer to those two questions are clearly yes for President Trump. I don't think he did anything wrong. The thing I find interesting is last week when the Supreme Court argument was happening, and, of course, you got the case in New York with Alvin Bragg, the DA prosecuting President Trump there in Manhattan. Alvin Bragg is arguing that President Trump engaged in a conspiracy to impact the 2016 election. Jack Smith is arguing that the crime is President Trump engaged in a conspiracy to impact the 2020 election. And as I said on TV this weekend, I actually think the real conspiracy is between Bragg and Smith. I think Alvin Bragg and Jack Smith and, frankly, Fani Willis are all working in a conspiracy to obstruct and impact the 2024 election. And you can just see that it's all been pointing to, we're going to have all these cases. And the theory is Democrats are like, we know Joe Biden can't go out there and talk. He can't put two sentences together. So the campaign is really Biden stays in the basement, Trump stays on trial. That's what they're trying to do. And now that they see, oh, shoot, if this case at the Supreme Court gets kicked back to the lower court and they have to sort through the facts and apply the rules the Supreme Court comes up with, they're not going to go to trial prior to the election. Everyone's like, oh, we're not going to have a trial before the election. Well, frankly, why does that matter? If you're just focused on getting the facts and the truth and figuring out what this immunity, it's all because they're focused on the politics. They're focused on their conspiracy. They're conspiring to impact the 2024 race. I think people see that now clearly, and I think it's backfiring on them, and it's why President Trump is winning in 6 of the 7 swing states.
Well, better than that, in terms of the overall, this is the latest CNN poll just breaking this morning. And again, it always means a lot more when it's a CNN poll than than it is a, you know, a conservative outlet's kind of a poll here. But President Trump up by 6 points over President Biden now. And those numbers get bigger when you add a third party into the equation like Robert F. Kennedy. We're talking just shy of double digits here. Now you know why they've got him tied up in the courtroom. And they're going to tie him up once this, if this one ended, you know, this week, they'd start the next one. And it's not coincidental. All of these charges, if you want to call them that, that they're levying against him, could have been brought anytime in 21, 2022, 2023. They held them until now so that he could be exactly where he is, locked in a courtroom and not able to go out there and spread the news to the people that he's got a better answer than Joe Biden.
Yeah. Alvin Bragg is talking about a supposed crime, even though they can't name it, a supposed crime that took place 8 years ago, for goodness sake. But we have to bring it to trial in the 2024, summer of the spring of 2024, right before the election. Give me a break.
Yeah, it is quite obvious what they are doing. Congressman, I want to ask you about what's going on campuses all over the country right now. I don't know if there is one, so I want to ask if there is a congressional action that can be taken of any kind. I think you and I, when we spoke on Wednesday, I mentioned what Elise Stefanik said, you know, certainly about telling any foreigners who are, you know, here on student visas, you're going to be gone if you are on campuses participating in these activities, which have gone so much past free speech. We're talking about threats, intimidation. We're talking about occupying buildings now. Is there any discussion among your colleagues on the Hill about what can be done to restore some order before what looks like right now is just starting to be rising tensions become something much worse, like serious violence?
We're looking at some legislation potentially this week that can pass that would be helpful, I think, on true definition of anti-Semitic activity on campuses. I do think what my colleagues have talked about, if you're here on some kind of student visa and you've engaged in not free speech, but in harassment and intimidation tactics of Jewish students, that's a different animal, and you should not be be allowed to continue on that visa. I think all those are things that we can look at and are looking at, and I think you'll see something passed this week in those areas. But this is, you know. Plus, there's just the fact that Israel is our dearest and closest ally. What happened there was terrorists attacked them. And the idea that now you have students on our campuses standing up and saying that they're for the terrorists is just crazy. So, and particularly when it then gets into harassing, intimidation, and violence, that is obviously a crime. And those students need to be held accountable who engage in that kind of activity.
Yeah, Representative Mike Lawler said to Trey Gowdy this weekend that Congress has to act. I just don't know what that act looks like. So you said there might be legislation this week that could.
Yeah, Mr. Lawler has a bill actually that we're looking at that defines and gives examples of what true anti-Semitic harassing activities are, and I think that legislation may in fact pass this week. We'll get a copy of that bill to you as well, because that's going to move, I think, on the floor. Maybe as early as Wednesday is sort of the tentative plan.
For the sake of clarity, is anti-Semitism in and of itself against the law?
I think yes. When you're talking about, I think it is. I think it goes past speech, particularly what we're seeing on these campuses, and that's what we're trying to make sure we have the right definition that Mr. Lawler has in the bill. And this is the same definition that President Trump's team had put together back when during the Trump administration.
Yeah, and the reason I ask, Congressman, is because people are wondering what can be done, you know, again, vis-a-vis the First Amendment. You know, it's what I just asked you would be almost like saying, is racism against the law? Well, it's not. It's not against the law to be racist. You can have an opinion about other people as much as you want, however misguided it may be. But when you take actions based on that feeling and those feelings, that's what becomes against the law, right?
Of course, excuse me. I'm sorry, Bob. I got to jump on a plane here, but I was.
Oh, okay. Didn't realize why we.
I got 2 minutes.
Sorry, you got 2 minutes to go. You got. Let me let you go ahead and get up there and get your bag checked. We'll let you get out of here, Congressman. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
You bet, Bob. Take care.
All right, there you go. You got it. All right, there you go. Now I know why. I didn't know why they asked to move him up to the top of the show this morning, but now I know why, because he's about to catch a plane. There you go. He was supposed to join us at 9:35, but you heard the airport racket start to pick up there. Okay, so we'll take a time out here, which is fine, and I do want to talk about that more a little bit later, what Representative Lawler's bill is. As a matter of fact, you might even hear some of that in the top 9 at 9, which is going to come up at top 9 at 9:35-ish. So stay here. It's Always Right Radio on a Monday on AM 1420, The Answer.
Answer.
All right, it's 9:33. Normally we would have Jim Jordan on, but since he had to bump up early because of a flight, we now have to do what we were supposed to do at 9:05 this morning. Are you ready? And as I say at the beginning of every show, as long as there's a 9 in the time, then we can still call it the...
It's 9 o'clock. Do you know where your headlines are? We do. It's time for the Top 9 at 9 on Always Right Radio.
Yeah, we can still call it Top 9 at 9. Let's do that thing. Here we go.
Number 1.
All right, big news. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former President Trump met yesterday in Miami for a private meeting suggesting a possible detente following the bruising presidential primary that they had against one another. The Washington Post reporting this. A tweet from NBC, by the way, confirmed. Quote, multiple sources confirmed to NBC News Trump and DeSantis met in Miami yesterday morning. A Trump official tells me DeSantis reached out 2 weeks ago to set up the meeting via a mutual connection to bury the hatchet and talk fundraising. The meeting was set up in the hopes that the two could repair their strained relationship. But Trump advisors were simply hoping DeSantis can make them money. And that's not surprising. DeSantis could help fundraise through his donor network, according to the Post. DeSantis' campaign brought in just over $20 million during his first fundraising quarter, $15 million during the third fundraising quarter, and his super PAC, Never Back Down, raised an estimated $130 million during the second fundraising quarter. So DeSantis and his team know how to make money. Trump is trailing Biden badly in terms of their campaign cash, so trying to close that gap a little bit is probably the only reason for the meeting. Some people speculating whether or not this puts DeSantis in the running for the vice presidential pick. I would still tell you 1,000 times no, that is not going to happen. But the fact that they are talking is going to get some tongues to a wagon.
Number two.
Speaking of the vice presidential race. A defiant South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem hit back at critics following outrage over her upcoming memoir that reveals she once killed her dog. Outrage spread across social media platforms late last week after The Guardian reported on an excerpt from Noem's upcoming memoir, No Going Back, which is set to be released on May 7th. In the excerpt, Noem describes taking her 14-month-old female dog, Cricket, to a gravel pit near her farm and shooting her. Because she was less than worthless, untrained, the dog that is, less than worthless, untrainable, and had killed and eaten several chickens. She said Cricket had ruined a pheasant hunt when she went out of her mind with excitement, chasing all those birds and having the time of her life. It was not a pleasant job, but it had to be done. And after it was over, I realized another unpleasant job needed to be done, she continued. In the book, she also described killing a nasty and mean goat at the same gravel pit, according to the report. She responded yesterday on Twitter/X, quote, I can understand why some people are upset about a 20-year-old story of Cricket, one of the working dogs at our ranch, and my upcoming book, No Going Back. What I learned from in my years of public service, especially leading South Dakota through COVID, is people are looking for leaders who are authentic, willing to learn from the past, and don't shy away from tough challenges. My hope is anyone reading this book will have an understanding that I always work to make the best decisions I can for the people in my life. The fact is, South Dakota law states that dogs who attack and kill livestock can be put down. Given that Cricket had shown aggressive behavior toward people by biting them, I decided what I did. End quote. This is not going well. She is toxic now. People are more livid because she killed her dog than they would be as if she had a third trimester abortion. You know this, because that would just be a woman's decision. But she killed her dog, and nobody likes that. But still, nobody is also quite as insane as a person on CNN. Listen to CNN lunatic Casey Hunt claim that the governor wrote that in her book and had that story come out as a way to suck up to Donald Trump because...
She's trying to, like, I mean, so Donald Trump, you know, famously hates dogs. He will talk, he'll use the phrase, like, so-and-so should be shot like a dog. Like, is that, is she trying to, like, appeal directly to him with this aggressive language?
I just... can't with these idiots on CNN. Donald Trump doesn't like dogs, therefore Kristi Noem said, I once killed my dog. Choose me, choose me. Lunatic doesn't even begin to describe these people.
Number three.
Speaking of lunatics, Cal Poly, that's California Polytechnical Institute, Humboldt campus, closed through the rest of the semester as students there have done more than just put encampments on the lawn. They have seized multiple buildings on campus. Siemens Hall and Nelson Hall East have been barricaded and taken over by the pro-terrorist protesters. The buildings are completely trashed with graffiti, plastered all over the walls. They've been under the control of the protesters for about 7 days now. One building is now named Intifada Hall. If you know what an intifada is, you'll know what that means. The occupation of Siemens Hall and Nelson Hall East is causing ongoing inability to operate other campus facilities, the school said. Since Monday night, protesters have attempted several times to break into multiple locked buildings with the intention of either locking themselves in, vandalizing, or stealing equipment. Vandalism and theft have continued across campus. The damage is in the millions, and it's still going on.
Number four.
Sticking with the pro-terrorist lunatics on campuses, Maryam Alwan thought the worst was over after New York City police and riot gear arrested her and other protesters on the Columbia campus, loaded them onto buses, and held them in custody for hours. But the next evening, she received an email from the university that made things worse. Alwan and the other students were being suspended as well. The students' plight has become a central part of protests, with students and a growing number of faculty demanding their amnesty. At issue is whether the universities and law enforcement would clear the charges and withhold other consequences, or whether the suspensions and the arrest records will follow the students into their adult lives. Aww. The poor little terrorist sympathizers are worried that somebody's going to staple their arrest and suspension records to their job applications. Good! They absolutely should. Questions also remain about their academic futures. Will they be allowed to take finals? What about their financial aid? What about graduation? This feels very dystopian, said Alwan, a comparative literature and society major. I'm sure you've got a great future in front of you with that degree. You got a lot of people going to be beating down your door for you to do comparative literature and society for them. For international students facing suspension, there's the added fear of losing their visas. And again, I say good. Don't let them take finals. They skipped classes. Don't let them graduate. Don't let them have any financial aid if they're not ready to graduate. Drag their butts back to their rock cave. If they're students here on visas from foreign countries, drag them back to their rock caves in their desert countries, the ones that they left to get to this country, that they now want to die. They want this country to die. And for the job seekers worried about their arrest records and their suspension records being on their job applications, if you can't find a job here, don't worry. There's always Gaza. I'm sure they're hiring in Gaza.
Number five.
One more on the protests. Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein was arrested herself, which is clearly a campaign publicity stunt, but regardless, she's a self-loathing Jew that simply has no tolerance or support in any way, shape, or form for her Semitic community. She was arrested with more than 100 others at an anti-Israel protest on the campus of Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Stein, along with her campaign managers Jason Call and Kelly Merrill Kerr, were all arrested at a student-led encampment soon after the candidate recorded a video saying they were going to, quote, stand here in line with the students who are standing up for democracy, human rights, and to end genocide, end quote. Stop there to point out the obvious. The only genocide that is taking place in the Middle East is the genocide of Jews, not of Palestinians, who technically don't exist anyway, but not of the people living in Gaza. We know that genocide against Jews is taking place because they said so. The genocidal Palestinian terrorists said so. The demand from the encampment was specifically for the university to divest from Boeing, which manufactures munitions used in the, quote, and this is the way they wrote it, ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza at their nearby St. Charles facility. This is what the campaign manager said. The Stein campaign supports the demands of the students and their peaceful protests and assembly on campus. Student protests for peace and civil liberties will always be represented. I'm sorry, has always represented the best part of our collective moral conscience, solidarity. Like I said, Stein is a self-loathing Jew. Anti-Semitism from a Jew is no less impactful than anti-Semitism from anyone else, just in case you're not clear. And anti-Semitism has to be addressed by Congress. This is Representative Mike Lawler.
Buildings. Joining us is New York Congressman Mike Lawler. Welcome, Congressman. What is going on with these threatening, dangerous protests on college campuses, some of which are happening in places where you are familiar? You're a member of Congress. You're following this. I mean, what is going on these college campuses?
Well, unfortunately, Trey, anti-Semitism has been brewing on college campuses for years. These students have been peddling in it, promoting the BDS movement. And really, obviously, in the aftermath of October 7th, it has been hypercharged. And Congress must act to crack down on it, because these universities and college presidents and administrators are failing in their responsibility to keep these students safe and to ensure that there is a free exchange of ideas, but based in truth and reality, and not anti-Semitic rhetoric designed to threaten and target Jewish students. And so that's why this week we're going to be voting on my bill, the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, which will require the Department of Education to adopt the IRA working definition of anti-Semitism and all of its contemporary examples for its discrimination enforcement cases. You have to be able to define it and crack down on it. And that's what we're seeking to do, because these administrators are failing miserably.
He's right. They are. And that is an important step. That's what Jim Jordan talked to us about just a while ago. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. Let's move on to
number six.
Former President Trump has opened his biggest lead ever captured in the CNN poll of the American electorate. He enjoys a 6-point advantage over incumbent President Biden. Trump is at 49%, 6 points ahead of Biden's 43 when the two are pulled head to head. But when you count in a third party candidate like Robert F. Kennedy or the aforementioned Jill Stein and Cornel West, Trump's lead over Biden grows to nearly double digits. In that multi-candidate scenario, Trump 42, Biden 33, Kennedy 16, West at 4, Stein at 3. That's a 9-point lead for Trump nationally, an astounding number that, if true, would signal the former president is on track for an electoral college romp of Joe Biden, which, of course, explains exactly why they have him locked up in a courtroom in Manhattan, so that Biden can try to take a bite out of that lead. This is a CNN poll. I say this every time there's a New York Times or an ABC or a CNN or any of these left-wing media outlets doing a poll. So you know it's not a push poll in favor of Trump. You know it's not something that is that Newsmax or Fox or Rasmussen or somebody is behind. This is a CNN left-wing organization poll, and Trump is on fire.
Number seven.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is apparently working on a long-term deal of being funded by the benefactors of the United States government, and more specifically by the United States taxpayers. According to a new report, U.S. and Ukraine, the U.S. and Ukraine are working on a scheme for 10 years of military aid. Zelensky revealed they are working on a, quote, bilateral security agreement, end quote, that would result in sending additional monetary to Ukraine over the next 10 years in a statement issued yesterday. Zelensky noted he had spoken to House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, thanking him and all the congressmen for their support of Ukraine, for voting for the $61 billion aid package that is coming to Ukraine now. Zelensky said during his conversation with Jeffries that he had emphasized the need for Patriot systems. Not the first time he's begged the Americans for more American-made Patriot missile systems to be sent to Ukraine. Currently, they have three of them, one from the U.S., two reportedly from Germany. On Friday, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin revealed that the U.S. would be sending Ukraine more Patriot systems as part of an additional $6 billion foreign aid package. You didn't hear that part, did you, on Friday? That's on top of the $61 billion that was already greenlit in that supplemental. Now another $6 billion in military aid. We are being robbed, and there is no other way to say it.
Number eight.
If you're planning a Disney trip, you probably should have your head examined. If you didn't know about everything going on at Disney and your head has been under a rock for a while, let me clue you in. A transgender biological male is playing Snow White's evil queen at Walt Disney World Resort's Wilderness Lodge in Florida. One family went and filmed the character, who went and filmed the character, said they had paid $300 for a meet and greet photo opportunity after their themed dinner at Storybook Dining at Artist Point, only to be greeted by what the father referred to as a drag queen. The father spoke to the Disney news site That Park Place, which broke the news that a man is playing the female character. The father complained to a waiter at the event who brought out a manager. The father stated, quote, "At one point, the manager claimed, 'I can assure you that she is a woman.' She went even further, trying to shame me, informing me that she was excited to get the part as the evil queen. For a brief moment, I thought, oh, maybe I was wrong. And then I realized I was just being gaslighted. I politely told the manager that I know what you're doing, and that I do not appreciate the fact that you are trying to be funny and disingenuous. So since the manager doubled down, I also doubled down and asked, 'Is the evil queen a biological male?' The manager's reply was, 'I'm sorry, sir, I cannot answer that.'" Disney, of course, in case you forgot, Disney now refuses to welcome people there by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages," because "ladies and gentlemen" indicate a binary. They will not use binary phrasing. No more boys and girls either. Now it's just children. Stay the hell away from that grooming indoctrination center known as Disney.
Number 9.
And finally, comedic legend Jerry Seinfeld has seen enough. Comedy's being destroyed. You know that. I know that. We've all watched examples of this, particularly since COVID, but more particularly since George Floyd. At least that's how he sees it. He explained on a recent episode of the New Yorker's Radio Hour that what is killing comedy in the United States is simple. That which kills everything in the United States, as Dennis Prager likes to say. Radical leftism kills everything it touches. And Jerry Seinfeld says that counts comedy.
Nothing really affects comedy. People always need it. They need it so badly, and they don't get it. It used to be you would go home at the end of the day, most people would go, oh, Cheers is on, oh, MASH is on, oh, Mary Tyler Moore is on, All in the Family's on. You just expected there'll be some funny stuff we can watch on TV tonight. Well, guess what? Where is it? This is the result of the extreme left and PC crap and people worrying so much about offending other people. Mm-hmm. When you write a script and it goes into four or five different hands, committees, groups, here's our thought about this joke. Well, that's the end of your comedy. They move the gates, like in skiing. Yeah. Culture, the gates are moving. Your job is to be agile and clever enough that wherever they put the gates, I'm going to make the gate.
So that's Jerry Seinfeld pointing it out. Exactly right. It is the extreme left and PC crap that destroys comedy and virtually everything else in this country. There you have it.
This has been the Top 9 at 9 on Always Right Radio. AM 1420, The Answer.
All right, we're going to have the phone lines open in a bit. We do have some guests coming up, though, but we will have some phone lines open at 216-901-0945. If you want to get in before the top of the hour, dial right now. Respond to anything you just heard from Jim Jordan, anything you just heard in the Top 9 at 9. We have a guest at 1010, so dial now. We'll get you up on the radio on AM 1420.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into a thousand years of darkness.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. With your host, Bob France.
7 minutes after 10 o'clock, which means hour number 2 is underway. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. It's the 29th morning of the fourth month in the year of our Lord 2024. Already, we've had a very crowded show. We had Jim Jordan on in the first segment of the show, a little bit out of order there because he was catching a flight. So we had Congressman Jordan. Then you had your Top 9 at 9. A lot of really important news stories there that we're going to be discussing in a bit. And I welcome your phone calls at 216-901-0945 for those. 888-281-1110. That will get you here just as well. I want to talk now, as I mentioned before the break, about DEI. or DIE, if you will. I still don't know why they ordered it that way. I think because they know when you switch the order and make a DIE, it is more accurate. It's more appropriate because DIE kills things. It does. Diversity, inclusion, and equity makes things die, including professions that are very, very important to our lives. As I said before, when you're talking about DEI hiring for a bookstore, it's one thing. When you're talking about DEI hiring for an airline pilot, excuse me, DEI or DIE being imposed on hiring decisions when you're talking about airline pilots, when you're talking about physicians, when you're talking about lawyers, when you're talking about, how about neuropsychologists, when you're talking about things that directly impact people's lives, maybe lethally, now we're talking about something different. We need to make sure that we have merit over equity. We need to make sure that we have qualifications over diversity. We need to make sure that we have people who are competent rather than people who are there for the earth for inclusivity. Well, Dr. Larry Brooks is a PhD and a visiting fellow at Do No Harm, and he wrote a recent op-ed for the National Review about the field of neuropsychology. It has lost its mind as it has been hijacked like so many other fields and industries by DEI. And he joins us now to talk about it on AM 1420, The Answer. Dr. Brooks, good morning. Good to have you. How are you?
I'm doing well, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for the time. I appreciate that very much. Let's start with the Minnesota Conference. What on earth is and was the Minnesota Conference, Dr. Brooks?
So, thank you very much. I'm in the field of neuropsychology, and we really are the testers in psychology. We are the most medical and science-based part of psychology. We work a lot with neurological patients, Alzheimer's, brain injury, stroke. So, over the past 10 years, there's been activists that have come into our field that are really trying to rework the field to get it more aligned with the far left ideology you're seeing on college campuses and so on. Mm-hmm. So the Minnesota Conference was really the capstone of their efforts. They're trying to rewrite the training curriculum for the next generation of neuropsychologists. And the draft guidelines they produced are replete with social justice ideology, systemic racism, the oppressor oppressed framework, intersectionality, et cetera. And my concern is it's really going to turn neuropsychologists from being healthcare professionals into social justice advocates, and it's going to reduce how skilled they are at their jobs, and as a result, it's going to result in harm to patients.
Yeah, well, I don't see how it can't. Again, you know, I mean, but let's talk about exactly what it is that a neuropsychologist does. You know, when I think of neurosurgery, I obviously know we're talking about operating on the brain. Neuropsychologists, as it pertains to, I think you mentioned Alzheimer's patients and stroke victims and so on and so forth. What specifically is the responsibility of a neuropsychologist?
Sure. So we're involved in a lot of complex diagnoses, right? If we do the testing. So one of the things we do are fitness for duty evaluation. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we do IQ testing, memory testing, problem-solving testing, and if you want to know if your pilot's too impaired to fly, they're sent to a neuropsychologist to see if they're able to fly. If you want to know if your surgeon's too old to operate, they're often sent to a neuropsychologist to make sure they're still cognitively intact enough to do the job. So that's a big aspect of our job, and we're involved in a lot of diagnoses around autism, ADHD, Alzheimer's, et cetera. And what can happen is if you have poorly trained neuropsychologists, you're going to get misdiagnoses. Think about how devastating it is for someone to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's when they don't have it. It's a death sentence and they're not dying. Think about how devastating it is for a kid to be diagnosed with autism when they don't have it. The economic impact on the family with tutors and therapies and special schools and the self-concept of the kid is totally changed. And we all know ADHD is overdiagnosed, but ADHD misdiagnoses have consequences. We see kids, I mean, I've worked in substance abuse treatment centers, and I see people come in with stimulant addictions because they were put on a stimulant like Adderall when they were a kid, when they never even had ADHD, and they end up an addict. So misdiagnoses ruin lives and have real consequences. And so that's how neuropsychology plays its part in the healthcare system and the danger that faces the public.
Okay. We are talking. That's a great answer. Thank you for that that explanation. It's important. Dr. Larry Brooks is our guest. He is a visiting fellow with Do No Harm. Do No Harm is an extraordinarily important organization that is interested in implicit formed to protect healthcare from the disastrous consequences of identity politics, among other things. It's a very important organization. So what allegations were there of this systemic racism within the field of neuropsychology that forced them to have this goofy Minnesota conference and to push all of this social justice stuff into the field?
Well, I think a lot of it comes out of what you're seeing across medicine is they look at disparities in education and health outcomes and attribute that to systemic racism when they don't contribute other consider other possible explanations. I think one of the things that's a little bit ironic about calling us oppressors who are neuropsychologists is a lot of us have spent our time trying to help people from all walks of life. I'm the director of a brain injury unit, rehabilitation unit. So I'm working with people with brain injuries and strokes at their lowest moments and with physical therapists and speech therapists help them pick them back up again. And so then to turn around and call us oppressors, well, that's a bit rich.
You're quoted, Dr. Brooks, as saying if our future trainees spend their time learning about microaggressions and systemic racism instead of neuroanatomy, they won't know the right side of their brain from the left. Is that an exaggeration?
Well, I'm writing an article, and I tried to make it into terms that people can understand. But, yeah, we have to understand. I'm glad you like it. It's actually a reference to the Book of Jonah, where they won't know the right hand from their left.
Yeah, I really do think it needs to be spelled out that way. I mean, because we're talking about, you know, while it may be, you know, a figure of speech, if you give somebody Alzheimer's diagnosis when they don't actually have it, you've sentenced them to death when they're not actually dying. I mean, that's going to change the quality of their life. It's going to change the way they and their families live the rest of, the individual's life and so forth. So we are talking about something where we can't be playing around with microaggressions. We can't be worried about pronouns. We cannot be worried about hiring people that have the right, based upon, their skin color, their ethnicity, their background or anything of that nature. We need people with the capability of truly understanding the brain and treating people appropriately. Otherwise, I mean, we're literally talking about lethal results, are we not?
I agree with you completely. That's exactly what we're talking about. And one of the parts that's so alarming is that there's an anti-science component to their agenda. So in their writings and their articles, they think science is a tool of the oppressor to help keep the oppressor in power. That is the theory. Not that science has lifted billions out of poverty, extended our lifespan through medical advancement. Science is a tool of the oppressor. We're a science-based field. So for us, antagonism towards science is really a form of intellectual suicide.
Do they offer any evidence of that oppression? What are they offering that says science is a tool of oppression? I mean, that's like saying math is a tool of oppression. And in fact, I have heard some say that, that math standards anyway should be lowered or discounted altogether when it comes to education because it is disproportionately affecting people of color or other various subgroups, what they would call marginalized groups, protected classes. So therefore, math is racist. Science is racist. What evidence are they offering?
Well, I think it comes more from a theoretical position than
actual evidence.
Right. So they don't believe in there really being a truth out there. They think there are competing narratives from different cultures, and one's not better than another, and nothing is necessarily more true. So they want to put, in their terms, what they call ways of knowing or experience around the same level as scientific evidence, which is obviously a very silly and dangerous idea.
So, Dr. Brooks, we're talking to Dr. Larry Brooks, PhD, Do No Harm Visiting Fellow. His piece, you should read it. It's in the National Review about neuropsychology losing its mind. What came out of the Minnesota conference we started this discussion with? Did they come out with an action plan? What do they plan to do, and what are its consequences, do you think?
So, they came out with draft guidelines. The reaction from rank-and-file neuropsychologists who did not realize that activists had sort of taken over a bunch of boards and committees and were pushing this agenda, the reaction was vociferous against it. And there were many negative comments and so on. And what's happened in reaction is that the leadership is really committed to this. And so they've suppressed some of the speech of people who are against the guidelines. Of course, you know, when you're against something like this, there's insinuations that you're against this far-left anti-science ideology because you're racist. And so as a result, a lot of the people who've been speaking up have quieted down, either because they've been suppressed online or because they're self-censoring because they don't want to be considered a racist. So going forward, the guidelines are moving forward. They're supposed to be completing the final draft. And it looks like, if it looks that they're going to be the way I think they are, this is why I say I think neuropsychology has lost its mind.
Isn't it okay to be against something that is far left and anti-science without being a bigot, without being a racist? I mean, to me, I don't think there's anything in science that should be far left nor far right. It should be science. Follow the facts where the facts take you. Follow the truths where the truths take you. It's not a political ideological field, or at least it shouldn't be. And anti-science is even worse, because we are talking about a scientific field, and they are professing that it is, well, I think the way you phrase it is, it's a tool of oppression. I mean, how can they oppose somebody who is opposed to far-left anti-science, ideology, or, you know, far-left anti-science principles, when those things simply don't marry, they have no business in the same room with actual science, whether it be neuroscience or others.
So, I mean, two thoughts on that. Number one, you really encapsulated my main point, which is just let's keep the politics out of science. Okay, that really is my main point. Number two, the people who advocate for this ideology are so convinced of its truth that they don't consider their perspective political. They consider criticism of it political, but their position moving in this anti-science oppressor-oppressed framework is not political. It's just understood to be correct.
See, there's the danger. That is far and away the most dangerous thing that you've talked about thus far, that they get to establish with their own ideology that their ideology is truth. And anybody who then criticizes that as not being ideological, you are being, you are being a denier. You're a science denier if you are pro-science. It's like Orwellian, doublespeak. We're literally telling people that anti-science is science, and that letting science actually be what it has been since the beginning of time, since the beginning of human understanding, that what really is science has to remain a science. That's what's being criticized as being ideological. I mean, we're literally changing the definition of words.
Yeah, the only distinction I would make is we haven't had science since the beginning of time. This is really that something came out of the Enlightenment, and that as a result of science, really resulted in a widespread increase in prosperity. It has done so much good for us. What they're proposing is to go back to pre-Enlightenment. Everyone just has their own ideas, their experiences, and their different ways of knowing, whether it's folk wisdom or some shaman. They have their different ways of knowing, and why should science be privileged over these other ways of knowing? I know it sounds crazy, but this is what's in the theory that these people believe.
Well, it is crazy. It doesn't sound crazy. It is crazy. And it is what these people believe. I believe every single word of what you're saying, because we see it in a lot of other people, whether it's climate science, whether it's, human sexuality or gender science, if they want to call it that now. But again, these things are not scientific when they're talking about just opinions and personalities and how people feel. Science is supposed to be something that yearns to be challenged. Science is, and again, I'm a non-scientist. I'm more of a humanities guy. I mean, I'm an English major more than an English major, so I'm not necessarily fluent in the field of all sciences, but I do know that science is supposed to welcome challenges, to find out, did your study get the same thing mine did? Oh, wow, you didn't? Well, I don't take that as a personal affront. I take it as a, let's study more, and let's see what the difference was and why. They don't want any of those challenges to come forth, because then it challenges not just their science, but as you said, their ideology.
I mean, think that's 100% the point. But part of the problem is I believe there's a bunch of good, well-intentioned people that just don't understand what's happening. And so when they hear words like diversity and inclusion, they think it means looking out for the underdog and trying to be nice to everyone and don't discriminate. Obviously, I'm in favor of not discriminating and treating everyone fairly. So when they hear those words, they think that's what this agenda is about. But this far-left ideology uses those words of diversity and inclusion to mask a much larger agenda. And I think a lot of people are fooled, and part of what I'm trying to do is help educate people within my field that there's something else going on here.
Dr. Brooks, it almost sounds like what you're describing is just another example or form of Marxism kind of taking over what was a capitalist republic. What I mean is, you use in addition to the DIE, the other word they use that's jumped out, of course, was oppression. And they use, you know, these anti-science people view actual science as a form and a tool of oppression. That's what Marxism is in its core. At its core, it divides communities, it divides cultures, it divides people into oppressors and oppressed. And if you don't stand with the oppressed, that makes you an oppressor, even if you are indifferent, even if you're off to the side watching it happen, even if you're trying to be a true, you know, truly principled scientist to see what the truth is. Nope, you didn't side with us, therefore you are an oppressor. That seems to be what is happening in a wide swath of our culture right now, isn't it?
100%. What's happening in my field is just a microcosm of what's happening in academia, in medicine, and in psychology. Look, in psychology, neuropsychology is the last bastion that has not fallen to this ideology. The rest of psychology is overrun by it. So, yeah, I think you're 100% right. There's this oppressor-oppressed framework. It's unbelievably divisive, and it's going to, and the downstream implications on patients is it's going to cause them a lot of harm.
Yeah, there's no question, which is, again, why Do No Harm exists. It's such an important organization, and I'm glad that you are a visiting fellow there and that you are continuing to work with them. And I want to steer people to the website there, donoharmmedicine.org, donoharmmedicine.org. I'm looking at it right now. And also make sure you get to National Review and look up Dr. Brooks' piece, which is extraordinarily important as well. Its headline is How Neuropsychology Lost Its Mind. How Neuropsychology Lost Its Mind. Look that up, read that, learn more about how extraordinarily dangerous this is. Dr. Larry Brooks, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it. It's great to hear from you, and keep up the great work. We'll chat again, I'm sure.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. Have a great day, Bob.
Yeah, same to you. Thank you. Good to have you. All right, that's Dr. Larry Brooks. Good guy. I really enjoy talking to him. So, yeah, that piece is important. If you know, sometimes it's behind a paywall, by the way. The National Review article depends on whether or not you've used other ones in the past or not. Like, I've got Kersenau's most recent National Review article in front of me right now, so Dr. Brooks is behind a paywall. So you have to find your way around that or go ahead and become a member or a subscriber, but check it out. Yeah, Kersenau, by the way, wrote a piece on Thursday, headlined Campus Anti-Semitism Again. I'm going to share some of that with you because it ties into some of the top stories in our top 9 and 9 that we just discussed. But Kersenau sent that to me so that I would have it to refer to, and we'll share some of that with you in just a bit. Right now it's 10:27. We'll take a time out. Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer.
The Answer.
Okay, 10:34. We do roll onward. Wow, it's been a packed show already. I feel like it really doesn't feel like we're halfway through. It feels like we should be like into the final segment right now. There was so much information we just got from Dr. Larry Brooks. We had a ton of information from Congressman Jim Jordan. Top 9 at 9 was packed as well, and it just rolls onward on this Monday. Thank you so much for being with us. So I got a message over the weekend from a gentleman who described himself as being a friend and associate of Mark Paquita. Mark Paquita's a good guy, strong conservative, fighting very, very hard for Ohio. He ran for Senate, as you know, and of course, and he wanted to bring to my attention HB 472, which is essentially an election bill or a voting rights bill or a voting rules bill, depending on whom you speak with, I suppose. But it's being described as something that would tighten the voter ID laws, allow hand counting of ballots in certain cases, and require voting machines and electric poll books to meet strict cybersecurity rules for, obviously, the protection of the election integrity. This proposal comes a year after, according to the Cincinnati Inquirer, after Mike DeWine signed into law House Bill 458, which enacted the photo ID requirement and other changes to the voting process. So some are calling this one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country, and some say it still needs to be stricter. So joining us now is Marcel, I'm going to guess that the pronunciation of that last name, the spelling made it a little rough on me. Sturbich? Am I saying it correctly?
You got it.
Sturbich.
Yeah, good to be with you, Bob.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Yeah, I appreciate that. I apologize for not knowing ahead of time, but it's the first time we've spoken. I do appreciate the messaging we've been able to send back and forth. So let's dive into this. Tell us more about HB 472.
It's a consequential bill. It's a constituency-driven bill. We really look at the systemic issues that have been present for probably a greater part of 20 years. And it goes about really hitting upon a hot topic issue right now with citizenship and identity verification. And in particular, we're able to solidify and shore up that verification to occur prior to the issuance of any voter IDs and assignment. And that's really the challenge today, you know, on that issue. Also, it enhances the cybersecurity standards for systems that certify in our state. We're using a 2005 standard going into the 2024 election. And what we do is we place it in the hands of the Adjutant General, and we ensure that a military-grade certification review is required before any voting system is even certified in our state. And we have the ability to do that because in 2019, we passed a bill here in Ohio that created what is the Cyber Reserve, which is an all-volunteer credential vetted group of people and professionals who are prepared. And we applied a high degree of standard that critical infrastructure systems are currently subject to in the DOD. And so we're bringing that high level of standard here, and we're upgrading, I guess you could say, 19 years and bringing a level of security as well within the voter registration databases. But happy to delve into any of those and give your audience a sense of why it's needed.
Well, yeah. First, I think I would like to know who would possibly oppose, strengthening of the election integrity rules, making sure that all votes are counted. They like to say, one person, one vote. I agree. One person, one vote. We need to make sure that A, that person is registered, B, that person only votes once, and to make sure that these people are legal. Why would anybody oppose something like the types of measures we're talking about?
Not really for good measure, other than to kind of bring up old arguments. I mean, we are taking what in effect is the recommendation coming from an executive order filed in 2021, improving the nation's cybersecurity. And so, Bob, it says that we need to perform enhanced vendor risk assessment. And what that means is we have to get a handle on the third-party capability developers who our vendors are leaning upon, who are determined to already be subject to foreign ownership, control, and influence. And so what we do is we ensure that information gets disclosed so that we understand and the vendors know what to expect before they come to the table. And when they provide that information, if there is a security vulnerability in the supply chain, which is what's different from the past, most of this you may recognize as people talk about this as well. If it's not connected to the internet, then it's not an issue. Well, cyber attack methods have evolved significantly from the 2006 law that originally said that the voting machines cannot be connected to the internet. We've also got new voting systems and products. And if you look at this, we can't rely on the federal government and an agency, in this case, the Election Assistance Commission, that has no statutory authority and uses a set of voluntary voter system guidelines that is non-enforceable. And so the vendor themselves, if they adhere to or don't adhere to it, nobody can quality control or check that. The workforce is not there yet, but will be after this law is passed, to start to build that level of cybersecurity professional. And we would have the strongest enhanced vendor risk standards. And on top of it, we would be aligning with, for example, let's say a left of center think tank like the Brennan Center of Justice that calls for greater election vendor oversight. The difference is we don't believe that it should be at the federal government. We don't want to turn our elections over to them. we can handle it and attest to it more here at the state level because we have the pieces in place.
Marcel, what does the Secretary of State say about this?
I think he's looking at it thoughtfully. He says some things are good. We want to help and work with him through this process as he evaluates it. We recognize that this is very consequential, and it would be involving bringing a third-party security developer. He's relied extensively on his board of voting machine examiners. The challenge we found with that group is that they are not cyber-credentialed. They're election officials performing a dual-hatted role. And when you look at the work that they do, they look at a system that comes to them for certification from functional capability or operability. That's the way our laws have been written since 2004. But our law is not written in any sense to address the issue of security. So we saw that as the gap. We went right at that, and we took the best standards we could find, the most up-to-date standards that the federal government and our agencies, in this case, National Security Agency, Department of National Intelligence, the Director of National Intelligence and the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, and we said they are saying that developers can do more and they have to do more, and we incorporated that into this legislation.
So, and I'm glad to hear that the Secretary of State is considering this, but he does say, and I'm looking at the article that you sent me from the USA Today Ohio Bureau. I think I referenced it being a part of the Inquirer, but this is a network, so it can be read in a lot of other different newspapers. But it referenced what Secretary LaRose said, that it does have some good ideas, but other things are unworkable. I'd like to know how, you know, what members of the General Assembly are working on that with him, and are they working with him? And then number two, I want to address some of what the ACLU said, again, quoted in this article, quote, "This totally upends our current election system in several different ways." This is the Deputy Policy Director for the ACLU of Ohio, Colin Marazzi, who said that. So kind of a two-part question there. Who's working with this, with the Secretary of State on this? And then secondly, we need to talk about the criticisms of the ACLU.
Yeah, thanks for thoughtfully bringing that up. Who's working? Are there two sponsors in the House? There are Representative Bob Peterson out of Spina and Representative Bernie Willis as well out of Springfield. And they're having those conversations, I understand. And we're also going to do sponsor testimony this Wednesday. We're opening it up in the Homeland Security Committee. Chairman of that is Haraz Ghambari. And it's a committee that has quite a few either current and or former law enforcement or military personnel. So they should understand and take to some of the security aspects of this that we have to shore up. As far as what's been brought up about upending the process, I would put it to your audience like this, right, to directly address that. In 2022, Ohioans voted for a constitutional amendment unanimously, 78%, that only citizens should be allowed to vote in our election system. And we followed that up with a voter ID law the following year. And so we covered our basis in a lot of ways, but then we have this crisis now where we have a large influx of people who are first-time applicants. And I want to kind of just give your audience a description of where this kind of loophole kind of comes into play. So we know from the Department of Public Safety that there's over 236,000 issued statewide ID and driver's license credentials to non-citizens. And if I am somebody who's come into this country through the border, and I'm facilitated to Ohio, right, by the Department of Homeland Security, and I have an app called CBP1, I'm already set for applying for social services. Well, when I come into a state agency, federal law since 1993 tells me I'm an employee, I have to offer a voter registration application to a non-citizen. And whether that citizen willingly knows it, in many cases they do not because they don't yet understand the criteria of citizenship. And if the person who's describing it to them is not thorough in that explanation, they potentially sign and fill that form out. The Board of Motor Vehicles or the state agency is going to forward that information. They're not going to determine the eligibility to vote. That's not their job. But they'll forward it to the election administration officials to process. And what we've uncovered is because we do not have a comprehensive database of non-citizens in our state, our county board of elections, which is the entry point, has no means or access for citizenship records, then they forward that to the SOS, and the SOS makes a determination and runs a check with the Board of Motor Vehicles, but they're going to sign them eligibility in the interim because they don't perform that citizenship check prior to the assignment of eligibility. And so voila, from there, non-citizens are entered into a county voter roll, and those non-citizens will appear in our e-poll books if they go through the process of simply using that CBP1 app, because you can apply through last four And that verification isn't going to happen until after the fact when we run our annual non-citizen audit. And that is essentially the reason why, and they can also vote for mail-in absentee ballots, because our voter ID law that was passed in 2023 doesn't require a submission or a copy of an ID. So as you can see, this process to do the verification is riddled with holes. And how many of those 236,000, which we understand is growing by about 1,000 a month as far as the issued credentials, is going to be or is registered, we don't know that, because those questions kind of have to come out of the annual non-citizen audit, and that audit isn't going to cover these scenarios that I just described to you.
And even so, it would be after the fact, like you said, which is extraordinarily important as well. We're talking with Marcel Sturbich. Marcel is a 20-year Air Force intelligence officer with joint staff experience in force modernization, and he validates information systems, does network threat analysis, and he sees all kinds of threats to the voting network here in the state of Ohio. We typically, this is just a general question, we typically hear the Secretary of State, and this is not a knock on Frank LaRose, whom I spoke with about this a little bit last week, but that this is the gold standard. You know, Ohio didn't have the problems that they had in Georgia, that they had in Arizona, that they had in a lot of the other states that led to the questions and irregularities, or whatever you want to call them. I call them fraud, quite frankly, but in those states in 2020. But Ohio is a gold standard. Ours was flawless. That's what we hear. That's not what you're saying, though, is it?
Well, what I'm saying is that we have some safeguards we have to implement, and we have to do it very soon. We've got the general election, of course, coming in, and we want all people. And, you know, I went overseas in many years, and I fought to ensure that those people of those nations had the ability to choose fairly and freely and securely their elected officials. And so when I come back here and I retire now and I see this, you know, I don't want to see a loss of voter confidence. And that's really what it comes down to. How much do we have to pay to fix some of these means or access issues so that we can bring confidence back? And if we can bring transparency, Bob, into the mix, which is what this bill's really trying to do, we'll build oversight over it from a citizenry standpoint, and then we'll have accountability that way. And so that is part of what I think needs to be understood and recognized. And so, yes, we want to expand upon the work they've been doing at the Secretary of State's office, and we think that this is a sure bet to secure and start to restore voter confidence.
Yeah, which is of course the key issue here is voter confidence. Can we trust that the votes that we cast are going to be counted, and that they are only ours are going to be counted, that non-citizens are not going to be counted, and so on and so forth. Complaints, again, let's go to a little bit more of what the ACLU is complaining about. They're saying that, quote, hand counting has been upheld by people who are perpetuating disinformation as a more accurate way to run elections. This came from the policy affairs manager for the League of Women Voters. The ACLU, as I noted, they're saying that these are unfunded mandates, and it's going to overwork and overstress elections workers. Can you respond to some of those, Marcel?
Sure. I mean, in 2010, our state afforded counties the choice to opt in for the use of the voting system and method of their choice. Mm-hmm. And what this bill or provision is doing is it's applying that equivalency standard, right? And an equivalency standard in terms of how you verify someone is important, and how you afford the county. So if you want to put it in a different light, if there's an emergency or a contingency situation where there's a disruption to connectivity at a site, should a county be able to step into and perform a function that still ensures that our election can go forward? I think so. I think that's a fair assessment. And, you know, if, for example, I know that that organization has been a big proponent of constitutional amendments and, you know, the electorate speaking out, and that has been a common refrain. Would that not apply here? I mean, this would not automatically result in each county undertaking that. It would require a petition ballot, which isn't that the fundamental of democracy? People speaking out. If we're a ground up election state, which is what we're often cited as, then we should also have that right at the county level to opt in, especially if there are conditions or high threat that persist in our system, and we don't have that level yet of trust needed. A county can go forward and set up their own path that's already equivalent to Ohio law. So I think if that would be the answer I would give back is, you know, self-determination, it's the counties that run it. They're the ones that would be able to meet the requirements that the Secretary of State puts forward, then I don't think it's an issue.
You mentioned the primary sponsors. We're talking to Marcel Sturbridge, and we're talking about Ohio elections and what we can do to strengthen and support true election integrity in this state. There's a huge bill. It's a very important one. It's HB 472. You mentioned the sponsors, Bernard Willis and Bob Peterson, and there's a host of co-sponsors. But what about leadership? According to the article that you shared with me, Jason Stevens is considering the bill, reviewing the bill, assigning it to a committee. But do you know if this is something that he supports, that if it gets out of committee, that he will call for a full House vote? And also, Marcel, do you know if there's a companion on the Senate side?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so he's the sponsors are having continuous dialogue, and they've had receptive conversations from all parties, even in the Senate. We are expecting greater interest, and there is an understanding and in the Senate side that this bill has been introduced, and I think there's strong consideration right now for introducing an equivalency bill. So we know that, you know, with this having been dropped in early April, we already have the committee. It's a reputable committee and a reputable chairman who can understand the challenges of our times. You know, if we don't act now, here's what really happens. Ohio continues to certify standards going back to, you know, at most to 2021, mm-hmm. which is what the voluntary guidelines are from the federal side. And so that's not going to ensure confidence. And we're not going to develop our cyber reserve to the extent that we could. Of course, our Secretary of State was a big proponent. We're glad he was. It's important to have that. And our Adjutant General certainly is somebody that would take an interest in this as well, as that would expand upon their mission. And as far as, you know, was brought up earlier about the unfunded mandate and the resources, there are funds and budget vehicles in place for this. What price tag do we want to put on this? And what are the user resource requirements? That's the question that those who would challenge this would want to make, right? Do we want to have people come back and have trust and confidence in these systems? Is it worth $5 million? You know, I think it would be. I'm just throwing that number out there, but just to kind of emphasize the point, if you lose the confidence and trust in this, and then what do we have, right? What is our guiding star going forward?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And, you know, I asked you about the Senate side. I asked you about whether or not Stevens is going to be supporting this if it gets out of committee. But then we have to get it to the governor's desk. And according to the article, Dan Tierney, the spokesman for Mike DeWine, said that lawmakers, quote, can't keep going back to that well with further bills dealing with the same thing in a different way without different fact patterns. It doesn't sound like Governor DeWine would be very interested in signing such a bill anyway. Am I reading that right or wrong?
Well, I think somebody contacted him. Perhaps they had not even read it, or we certainly hadn't discussed it with him at this level. I think it's kind of working its way to the legislature, and we certainly welcome that type of engagement. But as far as the fact patterns, there's no fact pattern that aligns to what previously was passed in that sense from 473. We're talking about a total revamp of security certification standards that get evaluated. We're looking at this not from connectivity to the Internet for a voting machine. We're looking at this from the supply chain, which arguably is even more important in understanding how the system was built, by whom, its design and its functionality to incorporate security planning into it. So that is a different fact pattern that I would share with him or anybody on their staff. And it would certainly set Ohio as a national model. There's also the feature of blockchain, which we incorporate into databases. That's a different fact pattern. What we would be doing there is we would be ensuring that if any adversary tried to gain access, as they've done on a number of occasions since 2016, and exfiltrated information, we would have knowledge to know if anybody altered our voter record. We would be using the latest commercial technology used in the finance industry, and that would start the process of being able to help us recreate whatever alteration occurred, and we could also recover our systems if somebody had access to them. That's a key feature as well within this legislation. So, you know, if we're going to stay with voting systems, and this bill thinks we will for a number of reasons, then we might as well put what resources we need and focus we need to ensure that the standards are not from 2005, that we can at least operate on a high level with 2024 standards, and we can do that through a statewide standard.
Last question for you, Marcel, and I really appreciate this wealth of information you're dropping on us this morning. It's very, very helpful. I think it was Bernard Willis, one of the two co-sponsors, who said this, that this could be a national model on how to make sure that elections are safe in every other state as well. Do you know of any other states are considering similar legislation? Is there anything like that happening, or are we kind of out in front on this all on our own?
We are out in front, as Ohio should be and has been in the past. We are looking at, when we talk about those security assessment standards, we talk about blockchain. Those are conversations that happen on a high level with think tanks that are looking at where they're going. You know, in the future, industry is going to want to push elections into an open source software. Well, here's something we need to be considerate of. If industry in a few years goes that direction, which will be more cost effective for them, then the management of all the software of our voting systems is not going to be done by that vendor anymore. They turn that over because it's open source software and it's managed by community of folks. It'll be turned over to the state of Ohio. Are we ready to assume software security review of the voting system software? Because that could be a reality within a few years. So if we punt on this, this is the time to do it, because we're in an election season. People are paying attention. Even if the security side of this bill doesn't implement by November, which it will not, but even if it takes a year from the time that the governor signs this, we will be in great shape, and I can guarantee that other states are going to start to come to Ohio and ask how we're doing. It would not surprise me if other states, there are a few, start to develop their own cyber reserves and build all-volunteer civilian or permanent workforce to start the process of building this verification. And we very much think this is the future, Bob, and we hope that our leaders in our state see that, and we certainly will work with all of them to help them understand it.
It just seems, Marcel, like a hell of a high mountain to climb, though, because the opposition to this is going to be fierce, especially in some of the other states if they try to model theirs after what we are trying to do here. Because, I mean, they rely upon opportunities to cheat. And I'm sorry to be so blatant about it, but they do. And I think particularly the people on the left know that they have to be able to account for the fact that maybe the type of trash that they are trying to force upon the American people, or the people of Ohio in our case, might not be something that they're interested in. And therefore, they need to have a secondary option. They cannot just rely on the people to do what they want them to do. If they vote against them, they have to find a way. So you're trying to restore or develop election integrity that is going to be a very, very big problem for them. And so I feel like the obstacles are going to be multitudinous, and they're going to be huge in front of you. So I'm glad you guys are out in front of it now and on top of this, and I look forward to following the progress of HB72 going forward. And thank you so much for the time.
It's been great speaking with you. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much. You understand, everybody, right? This is a very, very strong bill. It would eliminate so many of the different ways that the left can cheat. And therefore, the left will defend the current system, the one that allows them to cheat, by way of mail-in, by way of Dropboxes, by way of online, insecure cyber systems with respect to the voting machines. All of these things that they can do to cheat if they can, they are going to want to keep in place. So this will be a very, very hard thing, I think, to get past. And I really have no faith whatsoever that Mike DeWine would do the right thing if it got to his desk. So we'll follow it and see where it goes. Final hour is just about upon us. We are guest-free the rest of the way, so hit us up at 216-901-0945 today.
This hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by The Floor King and KeepingMedicareSimple.com.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This is Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
Alrighty then, hour number three is underway, 9 minutes past 11 o'clock. Good morning. Welcome to your Monday. It's the 29th morning of the fourth month, year of our Lord, 2024. That makes it, by the way, the penultimate morning of the month of April. You realize that, right? Seth, Sausage Boy, what would you say, what percentage of the audience knows the meaning of the word penultimate?
I'd say 10%, if that.
Yeah, I think most audiences probably a single digit, 5%. This audience I would give a better chance because it's an intelligent audience. And I mean intelligent audience, I mean that. But yeah, penultimate means second to last, by the way. So, Sausage Boy, I'm kind of curious. I saw a message, and I don't know that I necessarily comprehended it all because I just skimmed it, but Marcy was at church yesterday, and your name came up somehow. Did you catch that?
I did catch that. Yes.
What were the circumstances there? How did your name come up at a church service that Marcy went to?
Well, apparently somebody had heard me on the radio before this job, and heard that I like nuggets from a certain restaurant.
Well, we're just talking about sausage.
No,
we're just talking about sausage right now. The Sausage Boy part was a separate conversation.
Yes.
If I remember right, now I'm going to have to pull it up and look at it more closely because I only skimmed the text message here from Marcy that said, let's see here, where is it? Okay, hold on. Yeah, where's the part where she mentioned that you got brought up in church? Or was that only about the...
No, it's in here.
Oh, here it is. Two people came up to me at church. Two different people.
Yes.
Regarding Sausage Boy, Seth.
Yes.
And then, so first of all, people know that you are indeed now Sausage Boy.
Yes.
And that's a glorious thing. A better nickname for a better person, I have never heard. If there's nothing that would describe or define you, I think, better than Sausage Boy.
I could think of better.
Except that maybe there is something better. Because then part two of the message here, now that I look at it, is, Seth, when and where did you get... Do you get your chicken nuggets? Because church folk that knows your past want the answer.
Yes.
They know your past, and they want the answer.
Okay.
So apparently there's a story here about chicken nuggets as well, which, by the way, Seth, as I understand it, are not made of sausage.
No, they're not.
No.
They're barely made of chicken.
Maybe so. Depending on where you get them from, I guess, because some of them, I understand, are not chicken. They're made to be like chicken materials, but at any rate, they wanted to know where you got your nuggets, and I thought this would be a fascinating time to get the answer to that question. Can you tell us?
I used to get them at a Burger King. Burger King is where I used to get my chicken nuggets.
Well, why would that be a story? Everybody gets nuggets someplace at some time, right? Why is that a story?
I don't know if it's necessarily a story, but I mean, if you must know, I used to go to Burger King on a fairly frequent basis. All the time.
Okay.
And it got to the point where they knew my name when I walked in. You've seen Cheers, right?
Sure.
You know when Norm walks in? Norm!
Yeah.
That's what the sound was at Burger King when I walked in. It was Seth. It was everybody, including the manager and everybody.
Why were you so popular there, Seth?
The chicken nuggets were on sale for 10 for a dollar, and it eventually increased to 10 for $1.49, which is still a great deal. So I must partake in the chicken nuggets.
Who doesn't get a 10-piece nuggets once in a while? No big deal.
Well, I got more than 10 on a regular nightly basis.
Couple more? So you got 12?
No.
Sometimes?
No.
No. What do you mean?
Well, the phrase was, when I walked in, other than Seth, was drop 50. Which meant they would drop 50 because I would always ask for 50 nuggets and I would always ask for them fresh because I didn't want them to be like the nuggets that are sitting there already. I wanted fresh, hot chicken nuggets. Drop 50. So that was what.
Drop 50 chicken nuggets into the deep fryer.
Yes. And then usually it was accompanied by like five of those dollar burgers that they had. But yeah, 50 nuggets.
50 nuggets and 5 burgers?
And I would always ask again for everything to be made fresh. I did not want...
Were you throwing Little League parties at your house or something?
No.
Where there were a bunch of people?
No, no, it was no? not. No, just me and my wife and my daughter, which is... Yeah, I shouldn't really say that. It could be child abuse or something like that, but I... No.
So you're saying you raised your daughter on Burger King dollar chicken dollar for 10 chicken nuggets?
At that point in my life, things were financially structured in such a way that I was not willing to, you know, partake in a nice restaurant.
Okay, well, not that nobody's judging that in any way, shape, or form, but I'm just kind of curious. Seth, here comes Seth, drop 50.
Drop 50. It wasn't here comes Seth. It was more like, hey, a jubilant Seth.
Seth. Yeah, hey. Seth, drop 50. Seth is here is the point, though.
Yes.
Okay, which is making me kind of wonder now whether or not we have to come up with another nickname. So we might need to take a survey. We might need to do it online, or we can do it by the phones and let Marcianne, I just combined Marianne and Marcy together. Well, Marcy used to answer the phones. Now Marianne answers the phone. So anyway, let Marianne kind of keep a tally there. But now we have to decide whether or not you should be Sausage Boy or whether you should just be Nugget. And I'm starting to find...
Maybe you could always combine the two.
Then if I... Well, we could, but I'm... I don't know, because there's no such thing as a sausage nugget.
Well, not according to my wife. Different story.
I hope you're basing that on the food you used to bring home.
Of course. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
But there's a certain kind of appeal to just walking into a room and seeing a grown man and saying, "What's up, Nugget?" And you being that grown man.
I think there are better nicknames for me.
I think it's only two. It's a binary choice, Seth. You can't be non-binary. You're either Sausage Boy or you're Nugget.
I choose not to identify as either.
You may not have a choice. You've earned them both. You have earned them both, and I just don't know which one I enjoy more. I laughed my fool head off when Marianne called you Sausage Boy the other day in the studio, and I just said, that's it. You're Sausage Boy from now until forever. And it took less than a week for that to be usurped potentially by Nugget.
Man.
Because Seth has come and dropped 15.
It was a good meet.
How many days a week did you do drop 50?
I mean, the statute of limitations has run out, right, on CPS. I would say, you know, honestly, if I had to be honest, I'm at least four.
4 days a week?
At least four. I mean, that's
That's 200 nuggets a week.
Yeah.
And you didn't just eat them dry, right?
No.
I'm assuming you were dipping. Are you a honey mustard guy?
No.
Are you a barbecue guy?
No, I try to watch my sugar, so there's a lot of sugar and barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
So I went with ranch and buffalo sauce.
200 chicken nuggets a week dripping in ranch and buffalo sauce. And that doesn't count the dollar burgers.
But they were fresh. And so you figure, though, with the dollar burgers and the 50 nuggets, you're looking at a $10 meal. You can't beat that.
No, you can't, I suppose.
That's called budgeting.
You can't beat that to the coroner. It's a race to the coroner, for crying out loud. Holy cow, Seth. All right. So there it is. The battle is on. Sausage Boy or Nugget. We need to know. What are we calling Seth? Should I put this on my Facebook page?
Why not?
I think I'm going to have to do that. And we'll have to tag you into it. So let me just do
By
this.
By the way, the majority of people on my Facebook page said sausage is a better topping.
Yeah, you and your friends, you are the ones who have your sausage parties with. Sure, of course. Sausage party people are going to be favorable to sausages. And by the way, the fact that you so readily acknowledge your sausage party past is really, really disturbing to me. All right.
Got to do what you got to do.
All right. Okay, WHK, always, whoops.
Hello.
Always right off. Radio listeners.
Help me.
Who is he? Is at Seth Williams going to be forever known as A, Sausage Boy, or B, Sausage Boy, or B?
I'll vote for Nugget Boy here on the phones.
Nugget. No, we're not doing Nugget Boy. You're just a Nugget. Okay. You're just a Nugget.
We'll vote for Nugget on the phones.
That's it. That's it. You're just going to either going to be a Nugget or you're going to be Sausage Boy. You decide. Sausage Boy or Nugget.
Or Seth. We'll,
nope. That's not one of the options. That is not one of the options. So there it is. All right. I have it out there. It is posted right now. It's on my Facebook page. If you follow me on Facebook, you can, and these are public posts, so you can find me at Bob France on Facebook and the Always Right Radio page as well. But cast your vote, A or B. It's either A, Sausage Boy, or B, Nugget. And we'll let the people decide. And if you want to call Marianne, and she'll keep a tally there too. We'll add online votes to phone votes, and we will decide exactly who Seth Williams has trans. He's a trans kid. He's a trans kid. He's transitioned from Seth to Sausage Boy, and from Sausage Boy potentially to Nugget. So there you go.
For the record, those are all male nicknames. Yes,
it's a binary choice, though. There's no door number three here. There's no 79 different genders, and there's no 79 different nicknames for Seth. You are either Sausage Boy or Nugget, and that's the way it's going to be. Okay, 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. Back to more important matters. David in Carrollton. David, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you today?
Doing well, David.
First thing I guess I want to say is let's not nickname Seth anymore.
No?
And wasting radio airtime. It's just...
I guess maybe there is a choice number three. We could just call you Waste. Waste of time.
Waste.
You know, Seth.
All right, what did you want to talk about on voting security, David?
Voting security and ID and whatnot. I want to know how do non-citizens get a ballot to start with, and you know I have to show an ID when I go to vote. They scan the ID. Shouldn't this ID say somewhere non-citizen, and maybe those votes can be tallied in a different place, you know, so we know what's going on?
Well, there should be no votes to tally for a non-citizen.
Well, I agree, but as far as security at a voting place, it would be better to count their vote, you know, hand them the ballot, let them do the deal, and count somewhere else, as rather than have an uproar because they got refused a ballot.
Well, two things I would say. One is the biggest concern is people who are non-citizens getting to mail in their votes, because prior to this bill, they were able to mail in their votes without any actual confirmed identification, photo verified identification. So somebody can request an absentee ballot and just do it on a signature, or request a mail-in ballot, which is what we had in 2020, and just use a signature, or even the drop boxes that they put out there because of COVID. So I think that's one of the biggest things here, is to make sure that people who are non-citizens have to, let me rephrase, voters proving that they are citizens by way of those BMV-issued driver's licenses or state IDs. That's part of the problem here, too, is narrowing down what is an acceptable form of photo identification. Some want to use college identification cards. Some want to use, you know, work IDs or something of that nature, but it should be BMV-issued driver's license, or if you're a non-driver, you can get a state ID card. And to counter the argument that that's a poll tax because some people can't afford to buy an ID card, they are free for people who meet the poverty guidelines. So I think that's as big of a reason as much more so than being in person, because I'm like you. I vote in person, and they ask for my ID, and I show it to them, and they verify who I am, and then they give me my ballot, and I go vote. But it's more for those who are not voting in person, where they have not historically had to show ID.
I think I agree with people I've heard before say it should be a day off, and everybody should be in person.
I do, too. I do. I'm willing to do that. I didn't used to think that way, but when I was younger. But I concur with you 100%. I think it should be a national holiday. Make sure people don't have to try to squeeze in a vote at what might be a very, very long line in their lunch hour. Or make sure that they don't have to do that before their workday starts. They're going in at 6 o'clock in the morning, and they got to be at work by 7, and you know, and they got to, hopefully, you know, the line isn't so bad. Or they're going after work. They get off at 5, but the polls close at 7:30, and there's a 5-hour line. You know, I want to make sure people, you know, can all get there with easy access. And I agree with you. Make it a national holiday and make every vote be one day, and make it be in person. Unless you're military personnel, you know, and you are stationed somewhere else, you can still use that. The limited absentee ballots that we used to have, you know, if you are, let's say you're a college student. I've got two kids in college. Both of them are going to college in other states. They ought to still be able to cast votes for state races here. So they ought to be able to send in an absentee ballot. The limited absentee ballots, to me, are just fine, just the way they used to be. Otherwise, everything should be in person one day. No more chances or any of the chicanery that we saw in the 30 days of early voting that we saw in 2020. And in 2022, there were questions as well, because I think that's just, you know, that's just asking for trouble.
I may be wrong, but they could even open it up to 2 days, you know, but in person.
Yeah, in person for sure. And if you want to spread it over 2 days, I guess I'd be open to the conversation. You know, I mean, think outside the box, look for solutions. I'm with you. But I agree, it should have to be in person unless, like I said, you are stationed somewhere or you are living in another place right now or away from voting on that election day. And I think that is important. David, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. All right. And we're going to put you down as a vote for Nugget. Joanne in Twinsburg. Write that down, Marianne. That was a vote for Nugget. I'm sure I heard David say Nugget. I'm sure he didn't say it was a waste of radio at all, right? You didn't hear that, did you, Seth? No, nope, no. He said Nugget, I think, didn't he? Yes, very was. He very much was. Joanne, go ahead.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Actually, I think the organic part of Sausage Boy, you know, just that it came out of thin air,
true,
kind of wins for me.
Okay, I mean, there you go. Cast a vote for Joanne for Sausage Boy. I've got no problem if it ends up being Sausage Boy.
This conversation started while I was on hold, or I would have told her that when I talked to her. my question, I just had a quick question. I told her she didn't even need to put me on the air. Do we know if Dr. Piper is okay in Oklahoma?
Oh, yes, we do. I messaged him last night.
Okay.
I messaged him last night to make sure that he's good because I didn't know exactly which counties had been affected by those tornadoes. I wanted to make sure his was not one of them.
Just listening to the top of the hour news, and I heard that, and I immediately thought of him. Okay, that's all I needed.
So did I. He's good. No. He said the storms passed. The worst of the storms were about 10 miles north of him, so he had no concerns at all where he was. But obviously, we all joined in prayer for those who
there's still recovery and things like that, but at least he's okay. And okay, that's good. That's all I needed. Thank
Glad
you
wondered. Thank you, Joanne. And I'll tell Dr. Piper that when I talk to him on Thursday. He'll appreciate that. Charlie Brownhelm. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for taking the call. You were talking about DEI, which is all this woke crap that's going on.
Yeah.
This week, Biden's administration, through the Department of Education, changed the Title IX from a one-page document to a 1,500-page document. And they're, I don't know if you saw Megyn Kelly. She went off crazy. She really thinks that this is like the end. It not only ends women's sports, but it normalizes perversion. The United States government is now saying if you dress as a woman or pretend to be a woman, you can go into any bathroom. And basically, Megyn Kelly, these are all perverts. She goes, he's normalizing perversion. And it not only destroys women's sports, it destroys men's ability to defend themselves from accusations. Just, it's a travesty. It's one of the worst things I've ever heard of.
Well, I agree with you on the Title IX. I did not know about the 1,500 pages, though. 1,500 pages to describe Title IX?
Well, Riley Gaines was saying it started off as a one-page document, Title IX, in 1972, and now what they just introduced is 1,500 pages.
Wow. I did not know that. I'll have to look that up, although I'll take Riley's word for it. I've talked to Riley on a number of occasions. I'll have to maybe see if we can get her back on to talk about that. But that is a pretty astounding thing. And I concur. I'm just as outraged as you. And I'll tell you what, my daughter is now grown and she's in law school. But if she was still young and in sports and she had to deal with boys playing in her sports, if she had to deal with boys in her locker rooms, you would be talking to somebody right now who would you might not be talking to me at all because I might be in jail somewhere for what I would do because that is simply not acceptable. And I concur that these girls and young women, they deserve to have their spaces in privacy and safety and security as they always had. I am tired of this stuff.
Right. The government legitimized all this craziness, it's almost like the world's upside down.
Well, they didn't just legitimize it. They fostered it. It's their doing. You know, it's not like, oh, these things happened and like, okay, we'll take a position on it. No, I think they absolutely driven this. They have driven this. You heard, and thank you for the call, Charlie. Oh, by the way, Charlie, is he a nugget? Is he nugget or sausage boy?
Well, if it's Italian sausage, I'll go with the Italian sausage.
All right, sausage boy it is. There you go for sausage boy. All right, thank you, Charlie. Listen, it's a big deal, and I know we got to get to our break here. Maybe I'll have to address this on the other side. In fact, we'll do that. It's already 11:29, but I want to follow up on something Charlie said, and then we'll open it up to more calls. Stay here on Always
The Answer.
All right, it is 11:34. Final segment is underway. And phone lines are open at 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. I was just updating my Facebook page as well, just trying to make sure everything was right. We've got two choices there for you. And also on the Facebook page, and those are Sausage Boy and Nugget. We want your votes. We'll run this until tomorrow. Showtime tomorrow, we will identify our producer as either Sausage Boy or Nugget from now until the foreseeable future. And maybe an indefinite future. Also on my Facebook page, by the way, the CNN poll that I had in the top nine at 9-2. And if you've got responses or thoughts to thoughts about this, I would love to hear them too. CNN asking its viewers by way of a survey that ran April 18th to the 23rd. So it's the most recent one that they've done. While Donald Trump has been in a Manhattan courtroom facing a criminal trial, CNN viewers, the ones who are indoctrinated with CNN propaganda 24/7 to hate Donald Trump, right? This is CNN poll, mind you. Trump versus Biden. What is your opinion of each presidency? Was their presidency a success, or was their presidency a failure? CNN shows 55% of the respondents say Donald Trump's presidency has been a success. 44% say a failure. When it comes to Joe Biden, CNN viewers say, despite the nonstop pro-Biden, pro-Democrat, pro-leftist, pro-Marxist propaganda, 39% say Biden has had a successful presidency. 61% say failure. Holy goodness. This is the kind of survey, when added to the state-by-state, battleground-by-battleground polls that are being conducted, when you add those together, it spells landslide. The American people can't do this anymore. The American people just cannot do this anymore. They're looking at the price of everything. They're looking at the price of their groceries, 20, 25% higher. They're looking at the price of their gas, 50, 60, 70% higher than what it was when Biden came into office. They're looking at the cost of insurance. They're looking at the cost of a home. Did you see the home prices? Or let me rephrase. When's the last time you looked at what the home prices showed? I tweeted about this a couple of days ago, too. And again, this is a pretty good way to remind you to follow me on Twitter and on Facebook. Twitter at France Rants, FRANTZ, RANTZ, and then on Facebook at Always Right Radio. But I believe I tweeted this out over the weekend. This is just an astounding statistic. I mean, what does the American dream entail? What does the American dream mean to you? The American dream, generally speaking, by definition, has been, this is very loose, of course, but has been the ability to own a home, earn a living, raise a family, and retire comfortably. None of that involves getting super wealthy. None of that involves being in poverty. To live a good, honest, working class, and that work can be anything from plumbing to philosophy, I suppose, but earn a living, you know, at a job, being a worker, being a contributing member of society, owning a home, raising a family, educating kids, and eventually a comfortable retirement. So the core part of that, of course, is home. You know, right? Is owning a home. It is a huge, huge part of that. Here's the number. The cost of a monthly mortgage payment in the United States of America in January of 2021 on a, now this is a bit, I don't know a ton of people that live in a $400,000 home, but the cost of homes is so much higher now. More and more people are forced into that kind of thing. If you're looking to be in a middle-class home, you're going to be paying in the, you know, lower threes to the upper threes to pushing up near $400,000. So I've got to remember, this takes into account everybody. But the metric is the same in January of 2021 as January of 2024. For a $400,000 home, and the rest of this, of course, would be proportional. If you're in a $200,000 home or a $150,000 home or a $300,000 home, the same principle is going to be applied here. So here's the deal. The monthly mortgage payment for a $400,000 home when Joe Biden took office, January of 2021, this is for a 3% 30-year fixed loan, $1,349. $1,349. 3 years later, January of 2024, the same house, the same $400,000 house, your payment is $2,148 a month. That's an average cost increase of 59%. That's how much more it costs you to live in your home. 59% more. Like I said, that's for a $400,000 home. You can do the same thing with the same percentage rates and everything else and apply it to your value of your home. But that's what it takes to get into the same house now that it did just 3 years ago. And yes, that's Bidenomics. Yes, Joe Biden did that. So that's why these numbers that I'm talking about here, these CNN numbers, are so important. CNN, even CNN viewers are saying, yeah, you can indoctrinate us all you want. You can tell us about how evil Trump is. You can tell us how bad his tweets are. You can tell about how he's, you know, it was banging a porn star and now he's on trial for trying to cover it up. You can do all of the stuff you want to make me hate Trump. But the bottom line is, I got more gas for less money when Trump was president. I got more house for less money when Trump was president. I got lower crime when Trump was president. I had fewer illegal immigrants working in my kids' schools when Trump was president. It cost me less to fill up a grocery shopping cart than it did, went back when Trump was president. Bottom line is, things are far, far worse right now than they were. And quite frankly, we had fewer kids trying to tell me that they weren't boys and that they weren't girls and that they're not different species back when Trump was president. Not that Trump's policies directly impacted, you know, this trans contagion that's going on, but you do understand. When the conservative Republicans are in charge, when they were in charge, virtually the entire culture, and not just the economy, but the culture was different and it was better. And now when the radical fringe extremist leftists are in charge, everything goes off the rails. When Trump was in charge, there were no foreign wars. There were no wars in Eastern Europe. There was no raging war, even though there's a nonstop onslaught against Israel. But there was no raging war the way there is now in the Middle East. There wouldn't be, and there was no saber rattling of China with Taiwan either when Trump was president. So you can see why CNN, I mean, that number, those numbers are staggering. Trump is on his way to a landslide victory if he is allowed to run. If they don't lock him up in prison, they've already locked him up in courtrooms and plan to do so for the next 6 months. I mean, honestly, this is a very, very important and serious time. The fact that people are looking at Trump in courtroom and he's facing all of these allegations and all of this negative press and all of this propaganda, and he's still destroying Joe Biden in these polls, even in left-wing polls. All right, Jan is in Greater Cleveland. Jan, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Bob. Do you remember who 16 years ago made a statement, "This is the day we start to fundamentally transform America"?
Oh, it was part of his campaign. Yeah, it was his entire campaign. We're going to fundamentally transform America. Barack Obama.
Right. And we know Joe Biden idolizes him, and I believe Barack Obama is behind the scenes to a great. And that's what's happening. And if these young people who think the world started when they were born, they have no idea what they might be getting into with this new world agenda. I can't recall who it was, one of the